Welcome to the Intercollegiate Podcast. I'm Daniel Libet. This is episode 26. As you might have noticed, we have new intro music. I felt we just needed something a little bit more upbeat and energized to jive with the new American reality of us tossing public health caution to the wind and playing fall football during a raging global pandemic. So there is our contribution to that. A couple of items of housekeeping. First, since we last spoke, we have published our online updated directory on how anyone can make public records requests of any Division I athletic department that is subject to disclosure laws. This was a co-production of myself and our Extra Points colleague, Matt Brown. We hope it to be a widely used resource for journalists covering college sports or other intrigued members of the public. You can now find that directory linked off the top rail of the Intercollegiate's homepage. Secondly, we have just contributed a story to the Reset of College Sport issue, published online by Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. In our piece, primarily authored by my co-editor Luke Cyphers, we tackle the past, present, and future of college athlete outspokenness. You can find that story and other really interesting materials by going to globalsportmatters.com. And speaking of college athlete outspokenness, my guest today is Kane Coulter, someone who I've been wanting to have on the podcast since we launched. Kane is, of course, the former Northwestern University starting quarterback who in 2014 led the unprecedented effort to unionize his football team, a pursuit that didn't ultimately come to pass, but which made significant inroads and really redefined the debate over amateurism. Along with Ramogi Huma and Luke Bonner, Kane was a co-founder of the College Athletes Players Association, and as you'll soon hear, he has continued in recent years to try to find ways of establishing college athletes' rights to collectively bargain as employees of the universities that they play for. I taped this interview with Kane about 2 weeks ago, which was prior to the Pac-12 and basically every other Division I major football playing conference deciding to restart their fall seasons. So it's possible that our conversation would have taken a slightly different tone had we been having it today. Nevertheless, and without further ado, I give you Kane Coulter. So, Kane, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. Glad to be here.
I wanted to ask you because for the last couple of years, I've been trying to find you on Twitter in the hopes of conducting an interview and noticed that your Twitter account that you had been tweeting on had more or less gone dormant. And then at the beginning of August, you popped up again. You reemerged right around the time of the Pac-12 players unity movement coming to the fore. Can you kind of tell me what you've been up to before then in recent months and the last couple of years?
Sure. Yeah, I must say that me reactivating a Twitter account is coincidental. But yeah, I had to take a social media detox for a little bit. I was working, after finishing undergrad, I tried to play in the NFL for a bit and was practice squad and attended a few training camps and got cut in those final cuts. But after that, I was primarily working on college athlete reform and kind of overhauling the intercollegiate athletic system that we have. I was working for a nonprofit organization called the National College Players Association, which was founded by Ramogi Huma in the early 90s. And they have really been leading a lot of the reform movements and also, being the sponsors and drafting a lot of these bills that are now getting passed and to different state legislatures. And so we was working on that. And also, we had a organizing effort at other state institutions to try and create a collective bargaining unit. What ended up happening in our case at Northwestern was because Northwestern was the only private school within the Big Ten, the National Labor Relations Board decided not to exert jurisdiction in that case and kind of punted it, so to speak. And so what that ended, the result of that was that a lot of the rulings about whether college athletes were employees, whether they were had the ability to form collective bargaining units, that was going to be left up to the individual states and the industrial commissions. And so we were looking at different individual states that had favorable labor laws that we could organize in. And so we were pursuing that for a few years.
So you've largely operated kind of behind the scenes in terms of this effort. I haven't seen you, I've seen you've given a couple of interviews here or there, but clearly if you wanted to, especially in recent years where your effort at Northwestern is constantly invoked, you could have been much more out front. Was that by intent that you wanted to sort of work behind the curtain as opposed to beating the drum in front of it?
No, I mean, for those 2 years that I was working for, or for those few years that I was working for the National College Players Association, and also continuing our effort with the College Athlete Players Association, which is the collective bargaining unit we tried to start, I wouldn't say I was behind the scenes. I was actively pursuing it and trying to establish inroads with, you know, current college athletes and provide the solution to them if they felt like it could address some of their grievances and issues. Following that, though, I started working, you know, primarily in electoral politics and organized labor in different capacities, working for a teachers union in Wisconsin, American Federation of Teachers, and with the faculty and academic staff, Teachers Assistant Association, which is their graduate student union on campus, and a few other locals in the Madison area. So I was focused on that and took a break from sports a little bit and was focusing on some other labor issues So that took up, you know, the majority of my time.
Where are you at these days? Where are you based?
I'm in Colorado, back in my home state. I was most recently working for Colorado Working Families Party, which is a political organization, a national political organization, but they started a state affiliate or state federation in Colorado in 2016. And we're doing some great work on the state and local level, increased Denver's minimum wage, which will very soon be above $15 an hour, and did some other things that I felt like really helped the people and citizens of not only Denver but Colorado.
So I've read some of the things that you have written about, and you've done some other podcasts where you've discussed this, but can you tell me your impression of what that, the sort of marker that players organization such as it is set down as really the first strike that has been effectuated by players in my mind since almost you did your effort in 2015?
Sure. I must say that it's taken a lot of courage and strength and solidarity for all the players to make these demands and try to increase their participation in college sports, and I'm very supportive of it. At Northwestern, we actually didn't have a labor strike. We were just trying to establish that collective bargaining unit and try to increase participation within our own kind of management of college sports and in our sphere of influence, so to speak. It's definitely got a lot of attention, rightly so, I believe, and I think the consequences are have been felt throughout the nation at the different conferences. You know, the two conferences that started, the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, with the college athletes making their demands, they are the two conferences right now that have decided to postpone their fall seasons. And obviously it's kind of been this intersection with politics where, you know, you have the current president of the United States advocating for the return of the Big Ten and other conferences going ahead and starting their season, you know, without, you know, largely students on campus and without, the fans attending the games. So we're definitely living through interesting times. The pandemic has, played a significant, there's been a significant variable, so to speak, what's going on. As this kind of collision or intersection between sports and politics continues to unfold, I'm glad that people are talking about the rights of college athletes and whether they have rights under labor law and how this all fits in, especially with it, college sports today being, I think, almost a $15 billion a year business. So yeah, it's very interesting, and personally, I've been very supportive of college athletes trying to increase their participation and take control of their role in college sports and try to make it better for all the college athletes.
Now, as part of what they did, the Pac-12 players at least, they sort of set it up as a potential for a strike, that if certain of their demands were not met, and these were not insignificant demands, that there would be no playing. So we're now talking about a month and a half later, and as you mentioned, the postponements of the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, the two conferences whose players initially made these efforts. So the Big Ten now looks like they're going to play. I think we're waiting now to see what happens to the Pac-12. But if the season ultimately kicks off and if there's no stoppage, what is the consequence of that? Is that, or what is the significance either way if these issues are not really addressed, at least the issues beyond COVID protocols are not addressed, but players still play this season?
It's difficult to predict that. I think we could look at the ACC, for example. They've decided to move forward, and I think Virginia Tech had to ultimately postpone their two games just because of COVID outbreaks against NC State, and I forget who their other opponent was, but they had to postpone those games. And so,
That's right.
there definitely is this issue of COVID protocols trying to keep the athletes safe. Obviously, there's been decisions made by the higher education institutions to not have students return back to campus, but college athletes are still there. I was glad that the college athletes made demands that there was going to be essentially no firing without just cause, that they weren't going to lose their scholarships if they decided not to put themselves at risk and essentially decide to sit out the season. So I was happy that they were making these demands, but outside of kind of these COVID protocols and what the structure of college sports will look like, subsequently moving forward, I truly can't predict it. But I think that we're seeing this issue being taken up at the different governmental bodies, not the state governments, but also Congress and the Senate having these committee meetings. There's a the HELP committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, had a recent committee hearing on compensating college athletes and addressing some of these issues. So it looks like there might be some federal legislation to try and create some uniform standards, which we could see in the near future. But right now I can't predict that. And what I would say is that ultimately I think that labor and withholding your labor, it's a tactic that the college athletes can use to try and have their need their grievances addressed and their issues addressed as well.
And it's an interesting calculation about doing that in this current season because, on one hand, the motivation and the wind is at the back of college athletes to do that in a way it wasn't. It was kind of flying in your face when you were trying to just organize as a union, to say nothing about creating a work stoppage. But on the other hand, there's less to lose. There's almost less to leverage against because, there's if games are happening, it's with reduced capacity or no fans in the stands. There's less of a financial consequence to programs if their season is interrupted. It's already been interrupted. Can you kind of just work with me through the activist math on this about the difference between striking or creating a work stoppage at the level of a team or the level of a conference this season as opposed to a normal season?
Well, I think there still is a lot of money at stake, and there have been these enormous TV contracts that have been negotiated and entered into by the conferences and the broadcasting networks. And also, we've seen, ever since the citizens of New Jersey, they had a citizen initiative to try and legalize sports gambling, the NCAA and a few of the other professional sporting leagues had passed a federal law basically prohibiting wagering on sporting events. And what ended up happening was Governor Chris Christie ended up suing on behalf of the New Jersey citizens, suing the NCAA to try and, you know, have New Jersey have sport gambling operations. And the Supreme Court of the United States agreed with the citizens in New Jersey. And since then, all these other states have followed suit with passing their own laws, legalizing sports gambling in their, you know, different casinos and licensed gambling operations. And so I think that that's another kind of overlooked financial stream that people aren't really taking into account. But there's, you know, a lot of gambling taking place on these games, whether people are actually able to attend the performances in person or view it, you know, on the television or their mobile device or whatever it is, but also, you know, being able to place these bets. I think that there still is a lot of money on the table, so to speak, despite the current pandemic.
Let's go back to your saga at Northwestern. So it's been written about and was actually quite well captured in the book Indentured by Joe Nasser and Ben Strauss about the sort of beginnings and the preface to your interest in the attempt to unionize college athletes. And you've talked about in various outlets about a trip to a Chicago steel mill in the summer of 2013 that kind of really planted the seeds for you.
It was good.
But I'm wondering,
but yeah,
it was okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So outside of Chicago,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I'm wondering though, because I haven't read or heard you speak about whether or not there was any college athlete forebearers for you who served as a kind of model for taking on the system to any degree that was actually in your head at the time that you were doing this, or were you appealing to examples of other kinds of labor organizing that were really your motivation?
Yeah, it was generally taking from different experiences within organized labor and this right to association and to collectively bargain and participate in management and how different workers in different sectors, different industries have been able to fight for their rights under labor law and expand those rights to other workers and Americans. So it was kind of following their example. But since then, I have learned that there have been players before me that have advocated for some sort of collective bargaining unit or union. His name is escaping me right now, but I think there was a former basketball player at Duke University that was advocating the same thing. And they didn't, I guess ultimately they weren't able to establish that union or even make the court case. But, I think this idea has been proposed. And also, went off the blueprint of other professional sporting leagues, multi-billion-dollar sporting leagues, where they had established collective bargaining units and that had been kind of the best method for them to secure their rights and protections and to collectively bargain. I took those examples and tried to incorporate them into the collegiate athletic model, which I think had kind of strayed away from the beginning ideals of amateurism and had now become this enormous business that was tied to our institutions of higher education.
Can you tell me initially how Northwestern responded to you, even just at the level of the athletic department? Did you get any admonishment internally from sports information or from your coaches or other athletic department officials? How did they just handle not just an athlete who was speaking out, but an athlete who was speaking out on something that was potentially cataclysmic to the status quo that they were so comfortable with?
Sure. We weren't admonished at the beginning. I think that the athletic department actually expressed sentiments of support and, they were supportive of college athletes, especially, those players at Northwestern bringing up some of these issues that they believed were valid and should be addressed. I felt that the pushback from the university and athletic department occurred when we actually won the regional ruling of the NLRB and the Chicago region of the NLRB, the kind of local level where we initially took the case. And when Judge Peter Orr ruled that we were indeed statutory employees and had rights under the National Labor Relations Act, that's at that point, that's when I felt like the athletic department endeavored to try and have this kind of union busting campaign. That's when we received a lot of the pushback from the university and athletic department.
Before this, even in much smaller ways, how outspoken were you as a college football player up to that point?
I was you know, somewhat outspoken. I was captain on the team 2 years. Also, occupied a position on the team, playing quarterback, where I felt like I had kind of a leadership role and was able to kind of voice my opinions, but also hear the opinions of my teammates as well. And I don't think it's necessarily unique to Northwestern. I think a lot of these conversations were being had in locker rooms throughout the country on kind of the structure of the NCAA, some of the restrictions that were placed on the college athletes, and what the players would like to see done differently. At that point in time, there was no name, image, and likeness bills being passed by the state. College athletes couldn't even really create a YouTube channel and monetize that without the NCAA's enforcement committee having all these investigations and ultimately trying to punish the college athletes. They had this kind of quasi policing mechanism, and so these discussions were being had, and before we officially released our plan to form a collective bargaining unit to the press and to the media, we were having these conversations, as a football team, and sometimes across sports within the athletic department.
Can you kind of give me a little summary, as best as one could summarize that, of what those conversations were like, especially early on? I assume that in some ways you were bringing this to the attention, this concept to the attention of a number of other of your teammates who may not have thought about it at all, or may not have thought about it as a practical thing to aspire to do. What do you remember back from the beginnings of just those inter-team conversations about what you were thinking about and observing about the dynamic?
It's difficult to remember all the details of the conversations, but I remember, a lot of those initial conversations were surrounding health and safety protections and particularly health insurance issues. We realized that at Northwestern, and I think it was typical of most Big Ten universities, the NCAA did not guarantee that any sports-related medical expenses had to be covered by the university, but every college athlete had to have some form of health insurance, and usually that was provided by the player's parent or guardian. Sometimes players and parents didn't have health insurance. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act and some other subsequent changes have helped address some of these issues, but there were participants in college sports that didn't have their parents' health coverage or health insurance to fall back on. And the typical policy at that time was that the players had to pay the premiums of the school's health insurance policy out of pocket or with their stipend check. And we were, at that time, I was exploring this idea that they could be indeed employees, statutory employees. And just as most employers right now are paid, I guess the form of their compensation is indeed health insurance. And you have right. Current presidential candidates that are talking about the importance of employer-based health insurance and providing these different benefits for the employees. We felt like that could be, one thing that we could advocate for and try to provide for college athletes, especially if they were given statutory employee status. So a lot of those initial conversations had to do with health and safety protections and who was actually going to pay for the sports-related medical expenses. Was it going to be your parents' insurance that was being billed primarily, and the school is going to operate kind of as a secondary insurer or provide some sort of umbrella insurance, or was it possible that they could try and get employer-based health insurance as another form of compensation? So those were largely the initial conversations.
What were you handicapping this at the time that you were getting this together and noticing that you could actually organize your team in terms of whether or not it was ultimately going to come to fruition? Were you seeing this as you had sort of found the magic bullet that would upend amateurism, or did you think that it was more likely from the beginning that this would just present a very interesting thing and at least challenge the public awareness on the issue of how athletes were being treated and regarded in college?
I personally felt like it was more in line with amateurism. From my understanding, amateurism, I think self-management plays a large role in amateurism. And, when these intercollegiate sports were starting up at the different institutions, it was largely the players themselves organizing it and kind of, volunteer coaches and things like that. We've kind of gotten away from that, where it's become professional management, and the managers are often the highest paid employees of the individual states, the football or the basketball coach is usually the highest paid employee. And so we've kind of gotten away from this idea of self-management or participation in college sports, which I wanted to increase. And especially at Northwestern, coming from a very great management school in Kellogg, trying to incorporate some of those ideas and things we were learning. So I felt like it was somewhat more in line with this idea of amateurism. I guess you could try and base it off the Olympic model or some things like that. But my understanding from college sports was that it was largely self-organized, kind of voluntary association, voluntary management by the coaches. And that's kind of how it got started until, Teddy Roosevelt had to step in because a bunch of football players were dying and essentially create the NCAA.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so you had foreshadowed before in our discussion that the National Labor Relations Board ultimately at the national level punted on this by saying that they did not have jurisdiction over state-run schools against whom Northwestern football would be playing, and therefore they couldn't determine, this was outside of the realm of jurisdiction. So I'm wondering, based on what you knew at the time of that decision, which was in mid-August 2015, if it was ultimately a good or bad thing that it didn't come to a full vote counting, based on what you knew where the team was at that time after the pressures from the university on probably all of the football players in terms of which way to vote.
Sure. Yeah, I must mention, I think that they did have jurisdiction. I mean, we were a private institution and therefore subject to the NRA and the NRB's ruling. And I believe that the conferences in the NCAA are private institutions themselves. Now, you do have public institutions that are supported by the taxpayers, and they have to abide by their individual state laws. But I believe they did have jurisdiction. They just felt like if we allow one school within the Big Ten to have a collective bargaining unit, that it would bring instability to the labor relations. And so they decided not to rule and essentially punt. But yeah, there was going to be this secret ballot election. I mean, that's kind of the procedure set by the NRA. And, there was an intense kind of union busting campaign going on at the same time. So I can't say, but obviously there was discussions about, either way, if they decided to rule one way or another, that it was going to be appealed into, federal courts and maybe all the way up to the Supreme Court. So it was going to be a long drawn out process that was going to take, many years. But with them not exerting jurisdiction, that kind of stalled the case, but it still allowed the opportunity for players at other private institutions, whether it's the individual institution themselves or the conferences and the NCAA, to make the argument that they are employees, possibly even joint employees, and that they should be able to expand the bargaining unit that to address some of those issues that they mentioned in our case at Northwestern.
So you mentioned that in recent years you've been attempting to try to rally this effort elsewhere. To whatever level of specifics you'd like to provide, how close have things come?
Very close, very close. I do not want to get into the specifics right now, of those individual states, but very close. And we had some very good advice and resources provided to us about what states we should try to target first, as far as whether they had card check, which would have kind of addressed this secret ballot election and the union busting campaign that we had to deal with. If they did have card check and were able to get the threshold of union cards signed, then they'd automatically have that the collective bargaining unit. So we were looking at those states and moving forward with that.
And do you still think that right now this is sort of the engine, unionization is still seems like the best engine towards gaining athletes, college athletes, the rights that you believe that they deserve? Or is there another kind of organizational approach that might seem more promising given the current state of the world?
I do, and I also think that in some ways it could be favorable to the leagues themselves, in that I hear calls most recently by Senator Romney, who was kind of advocating for a cap on compensation at $50,000, and that helped Senate Committee Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee that recently was addressing compensating college athletes. From my understanding was that these other sports leagues, where they do have salary caps in place, they were only able to do that because they were able to have a collective bargaining unit, and they negotiate with these players' unions. So if they and you have these antitrust cases making their way through the courts, or actually I believe most recently was just ruled in the Austin case, formerly the Jenkins case, which was challenging this cap on compensation. Basically, making the case that that's what's happening is not whether there's going to be pay for play or anything like that. It's that they're actually capping, fixing the wages and compensation of college athletes. All the employers are coming together and saying that they cannot receive anything above and beyond what we deem an athletic scholarship, and they were challenging that cap. And so, if they did want to renegotiate some sort of cap, maybe in line with what Senator Romney was saying, I believe that they'd either have to have a collective bargaining unit, with the college athletes, a collective bargaining agreement, I mean, or have to get some sort of antitrust exemption, which the NCAA, their lobbyists, and a few other people, most notably Chancellor Rebecca Blank from University of Wisconsin-Madison, advocating for an antitrust exemption. So, like similar to what Major League Baseball has. So,
Yes, and she was of course the witness to the NCAA who claimed that Wisconsin might get out of the whole athletics game if players could get compensated beyond just their grant and aid and the cost of attendance.
And I personally believe a lot of these arguments are nothing new. There used to be a what they called the sanity code, in the NCAA, which I believe was kind of some sort of subsidies based on a needs basis. And if you were in the top percentage of your graduating class, or maintained a certain GPA, you were able to secure that form of subsidy. But eventually they moved towards a grant, what we have now, which is the grant and aid system. And the proponents of the sanity code were saying that this is pay for play, for them to advocate for some sort of athletic scholarship, that's pay for play. And so that's kind of in line with what we're saying now. It's like, we've kind of proven in court that there is remuneration, there is some sort of payment for this competition that's broadcast and bet on, and has become a huge entertainment product in this country. But now there's a lot of people challenging that cap on compensation, and I would hope that the college athletes can collectively bargain with the people in these institutions to try and find some amicable solution.
Are there any things that you've noticed in the way that the Northwestern unionization effort has been recapitulated that you would like to dispel in terms of perceptions or conclusions?
Some of the things I wanted to dispel was that the NLRB essentially, punted on the issue, or they didn't want to exert jurisdiction, or that we actually lost the case, which is not what happened. What happened was that essentially they decided not to exert jurisdiction, which, and they didn't rule one way or another. They didn't say that you are employees or that you're not employees. What subsequently happened, though, was that the general counsel who was appointed by the general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board, who was appointed by Obama, he issued a memorandum to the agency, basically addressing this gap in the NLRB's ruling, saying, well, you decided not to exert jurisdiction, but they didn't address the matter of whether they're actually statutory employees or not. And in that memorandum that they issued to the agency, he agreed with the case that we were making and said that college athletes at Northwestern University and the FBS football program are indeed employees. When President Trump was sworn in office and then eventually appointed the new general counsel to the NLRB, one of his first actions was to rescind that memo. And so that memo has since been rescinded. But I think that there is a misconception that the NLRB, I guess, ruled against us or said that they're not employees, which is not the case. There's actually evidence, especially given by the general counsel under the Obama administration, that we were employees and that other schools could try and establish their own collective bargaining units and make the same case. And bring it to the NLRB where, maybe it's more than just one private school amongst a bunch of other public schools within a conference.
Let's talk a little bit about your pro career. So you left Northwestern dealing with an ankle injury, and you had an end of the season concussion on top of all of the challenges that you confronted by leading this effort. You went, I think, undrafted in the 2014 NFL draft, and then were on several different practice squads over the next couple of years. What do you think the impact of your involvement, both in terms of the emotional toll it probably took, but maybe also a reputational hit it might have endured. What do you think the impact was on your professional career then?
I don't know. I think a lot of people would like to classify the NFL as a meritocracy, and you kind of earn your keep if you're performing on the field and can prove that you're one of the best of the 53 players trying to get on the roster, and about a dozen players that end up being on the practice squad. So I was focused on just proving myself on the field and not really worrying about whether the administration or the people in the NFL department were disagreed with my stance in as far as college sports. So I don't know that effect, but I can say that it was very interesting and educational for me to actually see what it's like to be a part of, have a union and what they were doing to try and address some of the issues that we were bringing up in the NCAA and then collegiate sports level, especially with all the research being done on chronic traumatic encephalopathy and the devastating effects of these repetitive head injuries. And I guess what they were finding out was that it wasn't necessarily the concussions themselves, but these repetitive subconcussive blows where your brain was running into your skull. And so they the NFL and with the pressure from the players union have had implemented these health and safety practices that I felt like were far more robust than what I participated in at the NCAA level. So that was cool and something that I valued during my time trying to play in the NFL.
Could you kind of explain why, historically, as far as you can see it, why there's not more pro players who themselves might have been victimized or exploited while they were college athletes who are inclined to speak out robustly on the problems in college sports?
Oh, I can't speak with any certainty. I would say that, for the 2% of the collegiate athletes that are able to, have a pro career, maybe that could somewhat dissuade them from speaking on those issues, or they felt like they were able to recover some of the lost, payment and remuneration that they maybe were barred from seeking at that NCAA level. But from what I understand, they have been very supportive, and that's been my personal experience that they've been very supportive, especially the sporting unions themselves, the NFLPA and the NBPA. When I was working for the National College Players Association, we created this program, high school recruit awareness program. The NBPA had been doing this annual basketball camp for the top 100 high school recruits in the country. And we were able to speak with them and their parents and guardians and bring up some of these issues and provide them with some solutions. So I think that they have been very outspoken and helpful in many ways. And I don't want it to appear like, you know, they're kind of overlooking these issues.
I just think that there's a lot of forces in play that don't create good, durable, sustainable advocacy on this front. I mean, we're talking about something, for example, where if you're a college athlete, you're there participating for 3, 4, 5 years, and then you're gone, and there's a new crop. And so that kind of factors in probably into the fact that it's hard to keep a sustained movement going on when the labor force keeps coming in and out. And then certainly there's all kinds of external pressures and reasons that, you know, players are dissuaded or discouraged from being particularly vocal on this front, even if they no longer are at the mercy of college sports. It either there's a perception that this looks unappreciative, or if you want to get back into college coaching, there's just a whole host of reasons why, you know, it's just, you know, why the status quo has kind of gone unchallenged, you know, for so long, or at least why it's the challenge is so far and few and far between. And it sort of takes somebody like yourself, who is a total outlier, who got inspired and was in the position to do this while you were still a college athlete, and was willing to take on the kind of the risk and the attacks that came with it. Is there anything structurally that's different today for college athletes, other than maybe just the environment, that there seems to be more receptiveness to athletes speaking out about their issues? But in terms of the structure of the system and the factors I was just kind of ticking off right there, is this still going to be the challenge for sustaining a movement that, you know, there's lots of reasons why, it's hard to keep a message going. And there's a lot of reasons why even well-intentioned people just don't want to get drawn into the debate over college sports.
Yeah, you make some good points. And I think following up on, the role of the professional sporting leagues, so to speak, the NBA, NFLPA, Major League Baseball, there have been a lot of people urging the professional leagues to participate in making some of these structural changes. Condoleezza Rice was appointed to head a commission, the Rice Commission, that was essentially urging the National Basketball Association and their union to kind of address some of these issues. And I think their recommendation was to have a large part of the sports be incorporated into like the developmental leagues and things like that. And so there's, you know, different solutions being proposed. And I think that there is certainly a lot of money being generated in this business and a lot of other industries that are tied in the sports apparel business, advertising, sports gambling, things like that. And so there's going to be some obstacles to try and, really reform the system and create a league that I feel like is equitable for the players. But for me, the more that the college athletes can be involved, the better. And I have just been trying to have more college athletes be a part of this conversation at meaningful levels. The way the NCAA is structured right now, they have a board of directors, and I believe like one or two seats on the board of directors is one or two of the seats on the board of directors is set for a member of the Student Athlete Advisory Committee, which is kind of this company union that was set up by the NCAA. But even with that one or two seats that's largely occupied by people in the Student Athlete Advisory Committee that have their own interests, to leave it up for them to advocate for the structural change or to try and get these rules and regulations passed within the NCAA, it's very challenging when they only have one seat. And on top of that board of directors, they have a board of governors, and there's no college athletes that are a part of the board of governors. And so I think that the more that college athletes can be brought into these discussions, and you know, if they are able to gain a seat at the table, I think that that's the best way to go, to have these discussions and negotiations, and, you know, ultimately determine what college sports is going to look like in the future.
So if you were Northwestern's starting quarterback right now in this current environment, in a pandemic, on the sweep of this athlete movement, what would Kane Coulter do in 2020?
I would be, you know, actively having these conversations with my teammates and other players across the nation, and trying to brainstorm, you know, different solutions that we can have. I think, you know, it's unfortunate with the pandemic that's going on, and I feel for a lot of the seniors that are going to have their eligibility come to an end very soon, and I don't want, you know, I feel bad that, you know, the postponement and kind of the crazy chaotic season that they're having to endure with, you know, with this pandemic, it's unfortunate. But I think that there, you know, could be some you know, solutions provided, you know, maybe allowing them another year of eligibility if they decided to sit out and things like that. But I think it's also, we're at a crucial time where you know, sports and politics are making this intersection and having this collision. So I think it's great that college athletes are finally finding their voice, and they're able to, you know, express their opinions on these matters that are dear to them. And I hope that, you know, through collaboration, they could, you know, come up with a great solution.
Yeah, the political bug has been interesting in the last couple of months, in particular, maybe even more recently than that. I mean, it was notable that President Trump really didn't touch college sports at all. He doesn't historically have much of an interest in the games and college athletics. So he sort of let it be for a while and sort of seized more upon what was going on in the NFL, for example. But yeah, I was pitching a book, you know, just before the pandemic that didn't go anywhere, talking about the unique bipartisanship that has cropped up over the issue of college athlete reform, and how it hadn't gotten demagogued, you know, by one side or the other, which was sort of fascinating in this current political environment, where it seems like there's no issue that can rise to public interest that's not going to then be split and along partisan lines and turned into a wedge issue. And yet it seemed like college sports had threaded that needle, except until now. I mean, now it really does seem to be a kind of political ideology play that's going on, including on the issue of whether or not games should be played amidst the pandemic. This really does seem to be mirroring the debate, you know, just the larger political left-right debate on this issue. And in some ways, it seems like a shame that college sports, which might have survived the partisanship, or at least college athlete rights, which might have survived the partisanship of the Trump era, is maybe now falling mercy to that. Do you see it differently or the same?
Sort of. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, you know, even before the current pandemic, you know, the Trump administration and his appointees, specifically the general counsel for the NLRB, had rescinded that memo to the agency saying that college athletes were protected by the National Labor Relations Act and had rights under those laws. So I think that, you know, whether that has been highlighted or not, this administration has taken definite steps to try and limit college athletes' rights and protections under the law. And, you know, there's also, you know, very powerful lobbying interests. You know, the NCAA has many lobbying groups, and, you know, the Knight Commission, which has, you know, been this organization that has, you know, prioritized college sports, you know, they're largely composed, you know, of former secretaries of education or current secretaries of education. And so I think that there are these powerful political figures that are looking at these issues and kind of behind the scenes trying to, you know, steer them in one direction or another. And I think that that's evident by, you know, the steps that the Trump administration has taken and some of the plans that the Knight Commission and other groups are trying to implement.
Can you help set for me some expectations on the front of the movement right now, going through the end of this this current college sports year, college sports season, what is a good indicator? What would be good indicators for how durable and progressive the players' rights movement is beyond just this one particular start of a season? What kinds of things are you looking for to happen where you would be confident that the status quo has not just regained its clench on the system, and that really some of the things that have happened are going to set a new reality for the way that athletes are considered in this equation?
Sure. I'm personally paying attention to the legislation taking place at individual state levels. A lot of it started with California and the work by Romelu Huma and the National College Players Association to pass some name, image, and likeness bills, which would essentially provide a freedom of contract for the players and allow them to participate in sports much like the Olympic athletes do, where they could sign outside contracts. And since California has passed that law, there have been subsequent states, even my home state of Colorado, to pass a name, image, and likeness bill. So I think paying attention to those and some of the rights that are being addressed in these bills and ultimately laws, I'm paying attention to that. And now at the federal level, congressional level, whether there's going to be some uniform national standards set. We could see some momentum and progress being made, with these Senate committee hearings, and whether that manifests as a federal legislation, we'll have to see. But particularly paying attention to that, and then also, the development of the sports gambling laws. Also in my home state, they recently passed a ballot measure, Proposition DD, which allowed sports gambling in the state of Colorado, and the University of Colorado Boulder became the first athletic department to partner with a sports gambling company. And so I think looking at some of these issues, the revenue streams being generated from those, how college athletes are going to be brought into that discussion on the money that's generated for there and its use. I think that's going to be important. In Colorado specifically, that sports gambling ballot measure they passed, they said all the tax revenue from the sports gambling is going to go towards the state's water projects, which is kind of vague, but trying to figure out all that, and then how some of these laws with the name, image, and likeness are going to play out. And I would actually like to see the video games brought back, with potential of group licensing deals, with EA Sports and some other companies. So I think I'm trying to stay optimistic. I think there's a lot of attention being paid to this issue. I think it's great, and I'm very glad that college athletes are insisting that their voice be heard.
And that was Kane Coulter. I would like to thank him for joining me on the podcast. If you would like to check out previous episodes or make sure to catch future ones, you can subscribe to the Intercollegiate via Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, or other major podcasting apps. You can also listen to shows off our website by going to theintercollegiate.com, where you can subscribe to the Extra Points newsletter with Matt Brown and buy our exclusive off-the-field distraction t-shirts made by Home Field Apparel. The Intercollegiate is proud to partner with the College Sport Research Institute. CSRI serves as a consortium for college sport researchers from across the country and disseminates college sport research results to academics, practitioners, and the general public. That should do it for this episode. As always, I appreciate your listening. And until next week, I'm Daniel Libet.